So thank you to Leon, my friend, and others, in terms of the organisers, for inviting me to come.
My apologies for the slight delay in getting started. We had a slight problem of dialogue between my PowerPoint presentation and the computer, which didn't recognise my newer version of PowerPoint. It did remind me that if I was unable to use it, I once heard a very excellent presentation made by someone who did not use PowerPoint, and he said that there were two kinds of people in the world, those who use PowerPoint and those who have something to say. You can decide for yourselves whether you think I've got something to say, but what I propose to say is this, that just taking a step back to begin, I want to just quickly survey the crisis of diversity management in Europe that led to the idea of intercultural dialogue as a key challenge for today in this open-air laboratory, as Professor Pache called it, which is Europe. So I want to then try to clarify, at least to my satisfaction, if not to yours, what we understand by intercultural dialogue and the term civil society. As I was discussing with Pietro yesterday, these are terms, including the term civil society, which can seem rather fuzzy and vague. And then I'll talk a little bit about some work I did a few years ago looking at NGOs in Northern Ireland, committed to reconciliation, and what we can learn from that. Professor Pache said I was an expert in the field. I haven't mentioned a particular field, which is, I'm not sure I'm an expert, but I haven't mentioned a particular field, which is football. If we have time, I'll talk a little bit about intercultural dialogue and football, but I think probably we won't have time, though that's an interesting area for discussion. I then want to talk a little bit about borrowing a phrase from a not particularly good source, i.e. Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, about the best possible democratic shell for intercultural dialogue to succeed. A little bit about the idea of civil society and national integration plans, and I'll conclude with a slightly dark final slide about some warnings from history. Okay, to begin with the crisis of the management of cultural diversity, which we have seen in Europe in the last decade. And as was mentioned, I was involved in the preparation of the white paper on intercultural dialogue. All the good bits are mine, all the bad bits are somebody else's. And the background to that was a long process which became known as the White Paper process, which included a widespread consultation, one aspect of which was a questionnaire that was sent to the member states about how they were dealing with this issue of managing cultural diversity. I was asked by the Council of Europe Secretariat to analyse the responses from the member states. And it became clear to me when I was doing so that there was a widespread sense that the pre-existing models of managing cultural diversity were no longer seen to work. And some of that is now being said in rather more dramatic and perhaps rather unhelpful ways, for example, with Angela Merkel's recent comment that multiculturalism is dead. What was evident from those responses I could see was that not just one, but two previous models were now seen not to function. The first, the classically French model of assimilation, the idea that minority individuals should subscribe to a dominant ethos, sometimes presented as if it were universal, as in the phrase Republican values in France. And the problem with this approach of assimilation was that in an age beyond deference, members of minority communities were simply not prepared to be rendered invisible in this way, and as we saw with the riots in the Banlieue in 2005, wanted to demonstrate their presence. Second model, multiculturalism, the idea conversely, quite different from assimilation, associated with the former colonial powers like Britain and the Netherlands. And in many ways, this idea came from a colonial background. Very much the case with the UK and India. This was the idea that, a very stereotyped idea, that minority communities were homogeneous and had homogeneous cultures attached to them, and that these should be politically recognised by government. And this approach, inadvertently, it is now clear, led to ghettoisation and mutual incomprehension. And it really ran out of steam with the riots in northern England in 2001, which pitted young Asians against young whites. But these were not the only symptoms that of crisis in Europe, which led to this idea of intercultural dialogue moving up the political agenda, as was indicated by the white paper process. There were other crisis symptoms, very severe ones, the Islamist bombs in Madrid in 2004 and London in 2005, the killing of the Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh, the Danish cartoons affair, and so on. So what does intercultural dialogue mean in that context? I think we can think of intercultural dialogue as a shorthand for a third paradigm, a new paradigm, for the management of cultural diversity, reflected in the white paper, as I mentioned. And if we explore some of what the white paper said, I think there are some key aspects there that are worth highlighting. All the way through the white paper process, there was a commitment that intercultural dialogue could only be founded on universal norms of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law, those same norms that, of course, the centre here in Padua is bound to uphold. And that was very important because clearly there is, or was, a view, a relativistic view, as was discussed yesterday, that no, these are Western norms and cultural traditions should be respected, even if those cultural traditions were to lead, for example, to forced marriage, to honour killings, to female genital mutilation, and so on. Right through the white paper process, it was accepted from the outset, and this, of course, goes back to the formation of the Council of Europe in 1949 to promote these universal norms. It was accepted from the outset of the process, and no one challenged this, including from the Muslim world, that these universal norms were the essential foundation of intercultural dialogue. In essence, without these norms, we will simply talk different languages to each other, and dialogue becomes impossible. What differentiates this intercultural approach then from the preceding models? First of all, unlike the idea of assimilation, it does recognize diversity. It does not simply say you are an abstract individual citoyen. It does recognize that you will be a person who has a unique identity and may have a belonging to particular communities. But at the same time, this diversity is recognized to be individual, as we discussed yesterday, and not to be collectivized, unlike multiculturalism. I mean, a nice phrase, for example, that Amin Maalouf uses, he says, our identity is not what makes us join a group. Our identity is like our carte d'identité in France. It's what makes us unique. And what makes us unique is the very complex and particular makeup of identities that we have, which never is the same from one individual to the next. And only in a very stereotyped view of an individual can we reduce that complexity to a very stereotyped, a very simple level. So, for example, there was a classic interview that Michael Ignatieff, the now failed Canadian Liberal leader, he wrote a book some years ago on this topic in the context of ex-Yugoslavia, and he interviewed a Serbian paramilitary in a bunker in the Krajina in Croatia, and he asked this guy the naive question as to what differentiated him from the guys outside, the Croat paramilitaries who were trying to kill him, and all he could think of was the cigarettes that he smoked. And Ignatieff muses on this, he thinks about this, and he says, well, the problem is that before the war, this man was perhaps a father, a music lover, a sportsman, a bar owner, this, or that. But now, to the people who were trying to kill him outside, he had just become a Serb. And so he'd just become a Serb to himself. So interculturalism is really trying to get away from those stereotyped and simplistic collectivized identities and to restore the individual at the center. And of course it is the individual who is the bearer of those universal norms. Only individuals can claim their human rights, can be protected by the rule of law, can vote in a democracy, and so on. An intercultural dialogue defines the task in managing cultural diversity as one of integration. And crucially, that is seen as a two-way street. Much of the discussion in recent years, as the populist radical right has grown in Europe, has implied that integration is a task only for members of minority communities, and puts all the onus on them, which is in some respects a retreat towards assimilation. As Habermas rightly says, integration is a responsibility of all of us, whether we come from so-called minority or host communities. The white paper was produced in 2008, launched by the member states. That word launched is quite important. Sadly, they did not endorse it because that meant they did not feel obliged to support it subsequently. And as we've seen, in fact, some statements by a range of national political leaders in recent years have been quite contrary to what the white paper says, and not just those of Angela Merkel. What's happened since the white paper? It's worth just quickly saying that it's been translated into many, many languages, including Hebrew and Arabic. It's been widely discussed outside of Europe, and there's been one interesting practical outworking which I've become involved with in Europe, which is the Intercultural Cities Project, recognising that intercultural dialogue is in many ways a challenge that manifests itself in practice on the ground in the city. Now, civil society, what is it? There are different definitions of civil society in play, and I think that does cause some confusion here as to what civil society is. There is essentially, as Michael Edwards has argued, an empirical and a normative version of what civil society is. The empirical version is civil society is a sphere between the economy and the state, which is populated by a range of associations. The normative version is that civil society is, in some sense, the good society, where people are committed to a set of civic values. And the problem with these two slightly conflicting definitions is that, of course, there are aspects of the sphere between the economy and the state, some kinds of associations which may not embody the good society. The paramilitaries I mentioned in ex-Yugoslavia are one example, or the mafia in Italy would be another one. And I think Michael Edwards has helpfully, in his book, Civil Society, reconciled these two definitions with a transcendent notion of civil society as conceived on the metaphor of the public square as the sphere of dialogue in the Habermasian sense, where for that dialogue to succeed, one not only needs the protection of freedom of expression, but also needs some norms of tolerance and so on, so that people simply do not shout at each other, but actually engage in a genuine exchange of views. And it's worth just saying, finally, that civil society is not limited by the boundaries of the state, that we can now talk in an embryonic way of global civil society as an emerging phenomenon of recent years, which is quite important in the intercultural dialogue context. When some people on the other side, so to speak, like Samuel Huntington, have talked about a clash of civilizations. So, what is the contribution that civil society can make to intercultural dialogue? Going back to the two models I mentioned earlier, in some respects you can think of them as being very vertical in conception, that the idea of assimilation assumes that the individual citizen should assimilate themselves to the state. The idea of multiculturalism assumes that the state should look down and recognize these communities as understood, different cultures. Intercultural dialogue in many ways puts the emphasis on the horizontal instead, by stressing the importance of relationships among individuals across potential or actual ethnic divides. And in practice, of course, it's a truism to say that the day-to-day frictions which arise from Diversity in actual contexts can only be resolved by organisations which are active and seen as legitimate on the ground. That may mean local government to some extent. It's unlikely, generally speaking, to mean national government. But in particular, some NGOs may be very well placed, both to be active and seen as legitimate on the ground in sponsoring dialogue. As I said earlier, there is a dark side to civil society. Not all civil society organisations are civil. And so it's quite important that what you might call the ethos of the third sector is aligned with the notion of intercultural dialogue that at their best third sector organisations would say they were responsive to their users and their members, that they believed in pluralism, different points of view being legitimate perspectives, and tolerance. And those values are essential to providing a good milieu for dialogue to take place. Another significant feature of civil society and dialogue is that civil society is a very complex place, characterized by various different kinds of social cleavages, for example, between men and women. And it's interesting in that context that a number of projects have proved to be successful in different countries, NGO projects which have been orientated towards women from migrant backgrounds and refugee backgrounds, and women from the indigenous community, which have brought them together on projects to do with insertion into the labour market or whatever, but have used that common bond around issues of gender equality to bring women together in quite successfully in a number of cases. Okay, some cases from Northern Ireland. I did some work, as I said at the beginning, some years ago, where I looked at 8 NGOs in Northern Ireland that had been around for quite a long time, in one case for 4 decades, which had therefore built a great deal of experience of the challenge of intercultural dialogue. And so I interviewed a number of individuals associated with those each of those NGOs, members of their boards, their directors, some users, etc. And what was very interesting was that it seemed that they'd actually all got together and conspired before I met them, because they all said the same things, which is always very satisfying if you're a researcher in terms of the consistency of the evidence. And really a number of themes kept coming across again and again and again as to what it was about these organisations that had made them the relative success stories that they are. I am not, by the way, someone who believes that Northern Ireland is overall a success story. It is rather painted in rather rose-tinted spectacles by much of the international media. I doubt if any of you in this room, for example, know that there are at the last count, 88 so-called peace walls in Belfast, which divide Catholic and working class, Catholic and Protestant working class neighbourhoods. That is far more than there were before the peace process, as it became known, began. And that's symptomatic of the fact that things in Northern Ireland are not nearly as good as they might be represented internationally in a rather superficial way. But there's some very good work has been done by a number of NGOs, and the point was being made yesterday by Pietro that one of the limitations of what NGOs can do in intercultural dialogue is that they're involved in discrete projects which only last so long and only touch so many people, so their impact may be limited both in space and in time. And that's a very important point, and I'll come on later to why some of the macro issues then are very important to ensure that this work is successful. But it is true of some of these organisations in Northern Ireland that they were able to engender what I called ripple effects, where they were able to have an impact that went across the wider society. For example, this NGO called the Corrymeela Community, which is an interfaith NGO which has been in existence since the mid-1960s. It has seen hundreds of volunteers go through its ranks over that period, and they've often gone on to set up other projects, or currently the Minister of Justice in Northern Ireland is a former volunteer, member of the Liberal Non-Sectarian Alliance Party, And so you can see these various effects that this organization has had in the wider society over the decades. But just to talk about these features that emerged through the interviews I did, it became clear that if NGOs are to try to pursue the challenge of intercultural dialogue, they need to be able to demonstrate these features, a clarity of purpose, a clear vision of what they're trying to achieve. They need to approach things in an holistic and a teamwork fashion, because intercultural dialogue is many faceted and has very complex aspects. They need to have an idealistic and creative culture in terms of their work. They need to have a long-term commitment to social justice. For example, it was said yesterday that intercultural dialogue will not produce a job or a house, and it's important that those who are involved in it realise that there are these social justice issues in the background which influence the concerns that they are addressing, but which will not be resolved themselves in and through intercultural dialogue alone. An important point is that it's crucial for individuals and organisations involved in dialogue to demonstrate reflexiveness, that's to say an ability to stand back from themselves and look at themselves and evaluate themselves so that they can see things from the standpoint of the other rather than simply from the standpoint of the self. And then finally, organisations involved in this arena must must exhibit values of interculturalism and cosmopolitanism. And I use the word cosmopolitanism there not in the sense of rootlessness, but in the sense of that Ulrich Beck uses to mean the inclusion of the other in oneself. That's obviously very general. If anyone is interested, I can give you a more detailed reference to that research if you wanted to pursue it. But obviously time doesn't allow us to do so. But I will just say a little bit about the conditions for success in this activity. It came up, for example, in the white paper process endlessly that we need to have what people called safe spaces for dialogue. Insecurity is very much the leitmotif in Europe today with in the aftermath of the major capitalist crisis of 2008. And ensuring that people feel safe in participating in intercultural dialogue is clearly a key condition for that dialogue to succeed. It's important, I discovered, that it was responsive to the individuals and groups who were to be drawn into dialogue, that it required constant activity, not simply a one-off exchange to work, that there had to be a focus not just on bringing people together, but on the quality of how they were brought together, the fine texture of the situation of dialogue, and it also required some creative use of the arts and electronic media, including, of course, social networking sites, as we would now say. And there were evidence, and there was some evidence, as I said, from these interviews where there were genuine ripple effects where I could see in the wider society these NGOs had been able to achieve results which went beyond their own narrow confines. But how do we ensure that the efforts of those involved in civil society are more than just a labour of Sisyphus or more than just a drop in a very large ocean? And again, Pietro made the point yesterday that the work of the Israeli-Palestinian NGOs could suddenly be completely vitiated by events like the outbreak of the Second Intifada or the invasion of Gaza, whatever. So what is it that has to happen at this macro level for intercultural dialogue in civil society to work well? And I'm borrowing here from David Held, his idea of cosmopolitan governance. And Held argues that there are three features of cosmopolitanism, and these were carried into the white paper, by the way, as well. The idea that we all enjoy as individuals a quality of individual citizenship. Secondly, that we each recognize that we share a common humanity that we all are part of, that we see other citizens as our fellows rather than only having, say, fellow Jews or fellow Muslims or fellow Christians. We have fellow citizens. And thirdly, that public authorities operate in an impartial way. and particularly stressed by Bo Rothstein, as I mentioned yesterday, in his discussion of trust, in order to be able to address the various competing claims that may come from within society, from different cultural quarters, so that they can be resolved in a way which everyone finds acceptable. Impartial authority is also associated with the notion of Ulrich Beck, of what he calls constitutional tolerance. I think that's a very interesting idea. He's taking it from the earlier idea of religious tolerance, and just as multi-religious states can only function if the state itself is neutral to allow the freedom of conscience of all, he argues that in today's multinational states, like his own native Germany, the state must be neutral between ethnic national identities, so that all can feel they can share the same space. Often social policies are discussed in isolation from the cultural arena, as was also mentioned yesterday. One of the things that didn't get into the white paper that I drafted, because this would have been seen as too much of an alignment with the social democratic states in Europe, was to stress Rothstein's point that if you really want to have a high trust society, you really want to have a universal welfare state in the manner of the Nordic countries. When people are asked in the European Values survey, do you think most people can be trusted, or do you think you have to look after yourself? And obviously that risks breaking down long ethnic dividing lines. The Nordic countries always show a much more positive response, much more trusting than the other European countries. One of the things that we did discuss in the white paper, which was emerging as we were working on the white paper, that I think is a useful way forward, is the idea of national integration plans, which I think do provide the best possible context for intercultural dialogue to take place in any particular national environment. It's very difficult nowadays for governments to manage anything as complex as intercultural dialogue, and the first thing they have to do is to find a way of providing a joined up response across government, and these national plans I think have been useful ways of doing that. Certainly I think the Spanish one, which was introduced in 2007-2008, is very good, and also at the local level Barcelona has produced an integration plan which is also very impressive. But because of the limitations of states, even at local level, it is critically important that minority and intercultural civil society organisations, which may have more credibility on the ground and more contact with the ground, are involved in the design of such plans and in their delivery on a day-to-day basis. For that to work, it is of course essential that civil society organisations and political leaders both affirm that they believe that diversity is an advantage and not a threat. One of the things that has frustrated civil society organisations in Northern Ireland over the years committed to reconciliation is that often their work has been undone by local political leaders making inflammatory comments which have made their work on the ground very difficult. It wasn't to be my last slide. My last slide seems to have terminated, maybe because I've gone over my time. Oh, here we are. And this is my warning from history. It is, of course, the case, as I've said, that nationalistic populism is on the rise across Europe. In the wake of the recent crisis, that has been most evident in those countries where civil society is weakest, like Hungary, with Jobbik and paramilitary phenomena there. But it's been a growing threat even in the Nordic countries, if one takes the 5% vote for the Sweden Democrats in the recent elections as an example. This nationalistic populism risks being given credit by mainstream political leaders. I think that we need to recognise that political parties are themselves part of civil society, and if civil society is to perform the role that it can do in intercultural dialogue, on this I'll conclude, the minimum contribution that political parties must make is to determine that, as it's been put in a UK context, they will not be willing to play the race card because we know, of course, from the history that led to the formation of the Council of Europe in 1949, the history that led Europe to say, never again, in 1949, the history that led Europe to say we must all agree to universal values of democracy, human rights, and the rule of law, that history, the product of the economic